Hi, this is Mark Cuniberti. You're about to listen to another edition of our award-winning economics show entitled Money Matters. Before we begin, please be advised that the views and opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests, and are opinions only, and may not necessarily reflect those of this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. This show is not meant as investment advice. Consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions, and do your own research before investing. The information given on this show is obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing, but is not guaranteed. This show is pre-recorded at an earlier date, so market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at time of airing, and we will not be taking any listener call-ins. You can order past shows or a comment on our show by sending us an email at mark@moneymanagementradio.com or by visiting our website, moneymanagementradio.com. Thanks again for listening. Now enjoy the show.
And welcome to the 213th show of your economic forum entitled Money Matters. This is host Mark Cuniberti thanking you for tuning in to your community radio station. Show number 213, Oh, No More Grease in the Fire. And we'll be talking about Greece today. I know we've talked about Greece so many times, but they're still in the news. They keep coming back like a bad penny. Basically, that's all they have. We'll cover Greece, some letters from listeners. Talk about the Triple Crown and the war cycles today. And a little bit about the Dow and a investment called a Unit Investment Trust, or UIT. Kind of an odd little investment thing. And we'll also talk about more dividend-paying stocks today. So, money. This show was about that. Show is about money, as money does matter, and the matters of money affect us all in some way or another. Whether you have a lot of it, a little of it, or none of it, it controls our economy, our country, and our planet in some way or another, controls the very way we live our lives. It's about your money, your lack of it, or abundance of it, about our life and livelihood. In short, money matters is about you. Remember, the more you know about money, like the more you visualize health, the more comes to you. So that's why we're here, to educate you about money. You know, most financial talk shows talk about stocks and bonds and, well, the majority of you, really, statistically, don't own stocks and bonds. So we don't talk a lot about stocks and bonds. We do some in more of a macro level, not specifically, more of a macro level, talking about what's happening in the world that'll affect you, not only those real rich people that own big portfolios of stocks and bonds, because it's... This show will cover a lot of that, but it also covers the ground roots, general existence people like you and I that are just here trying to make a living, trying to make a buck. So we go into the Money Matters mailbag. You can send me an email no matter where you're listening to the show, or no matter what time you're listening to the show, or what day. You just send me an email at the originating station. That's where my email is. Now, you can always send an email to the program director at whatever station you're hearing this on, wherever that is, or you can send it directly to me. And my email is real simple. It's moneymatters@kvmr.org. moneymatters@kvmr.org. Now, you may not be hearing this on kvmr.org if you're hearing it recorded on another day other than Thursday, June 18th at noon Pacific Standard Time. You can still send me an email. My email doesn't shut off when the program ends. And I read emails on the air every show. In fact, I take a few. So I would like to attend a money class. I'm currently stateside. Is there a class soon? Vicky. Sometime in the summer, yeah. Well, I haven't really put a date on it. But I am planning one, so you can just, again, if you're interested in the money class, send me an email at moneymatters@kvmr.org. Now, I've been talked to about doing a podcast for everyone, everywhere. So I'd like listener comments on that. If you think a podcast would benefit you, then send me an email and say, yeah, I'd like a podcast. But a show's coming up. I mean, a class is coming up in the late summer, probably. So I'll let you know about that. Now, you can also get the newsletter, the Money Matters newsletter, and that is a gift from this community radio station.
a gift to you for nothing in return, just for listening to Money Matters, and you just send me an email and I'll put you on the newsletter list. We don't sell any of the email addresses. Nobody sees your email address but me and maybe the webmaster. And you get a newsletter that comes out sporadically, repeatedly, and it talks about general market conditions and give you some nice articles to read, what's happening in the markets in an overall sense of the word. And we'll talk about, don't talk about politics much. Every time we talk about politics, we get into trouble because everybody's got a different spin on politics. But when there's an economic thing, issue such as, you know, the Obama health care or bonds or new program or bailout, we will talk about it because it does affect you. Contrary to all belief, when the government does something, it does affect you. Most people think, well, it doesn't affect you. The government pays for it. Well, the government is you, and I know you don't think that you pay for it. You don't get an invoice. You don't get a bill saying, here's your $28 bill and 30 cents for bullets in Afghanistan. You don't get a bill, but you do pay for it. Now, how do you pay for when the government spends something? Well, you pay for it in a rather roundabout way, but it is directly, most of it is coming from the government. And how you pay for it is when you buy things, when you go to the store, or when you go get gasoline, or when you go get a haircut, or whatever you do, whatever you buy, a part of that price is there because of the government spending. And how do we quantify that? Well, everybody says, you know, in the 1900s, early 1900s, the candy bar was 5 cents. Today, they're a dollar. So you've got a, what is that, 20,000% increase, 2,000% increase in the price of a candy bar. Well, you might think that the increase of a price of a candy bar is normal, but it really is really not normal. In fact, it's abnormal, because in the old days, people used to make candy bars by hand, and it was much more expensive to pick cocoa beans by hand. And so now with the advent of technology, we can make many, many candy bars and pick many, many cocoa beans and process it a lot faster. So candy bars should be cheaper, but they are not. Remember, they would say, but the advent of technology, we'll get better at things, and we'll be able to make things real cheap, and you'll be able to sit home most of the day because the robots will do all the work. Well, we're not finding that to be true. We're finding that not only did that not happen, things got cheaper. Things got much more expensive, and now where we used to have a single earner in the household, a little bus driver could support a family of four and pay for their health care and take them to the doctor and pay for their college if you worked a little overtime. Despite all the technological improvements, now we need two people to just barely get by, and most people are not even getting by. They're in debt up to their yin-yang. Why is that? Why, with the advent of technology and the promise that things were going to get better, are things actually more expensive, even though we've gotten a lot better at making things? Materials are cheaper, plastic replaces metal, better ways of making things, making metals thinner. Everything we've done is to improve the efficiency of how we make stuff. But things have actually gone up in price. That increase in price in everything you buy is the bill that comes from the government spending things. And if the government took in the same amount of money it spends, the price of a candy bar would never go up. There are some issues that might make it go up on its own. Cocoa bean have a disease or something. But the price of the candy bar should be going down from a nickel, not up. But not only is it not staying the same, it's going up, and they're going up by a lot. In fact, we've accepted inflation. We've accepted inflation as a part of our normal everyday economy. But it is not normal. It is only, there are varieties of inflation that are temporary, like a disease in the cocoa crop, the cocoa bean crop, or a shortage of water would make the price of water go up temporarily. But overall, we are better at making chocolate bars, and we are better at getting water more efficiently, but yet those prices are going up despite the fact that there are no temporary
situations that are actually increasing the costs there. Maybe in water, there's a drought right now, but for the most part, things should be going down in price, but they are going up. That is the bill that you are paying from government spending more than it takes in. Okay, if government would take in as much as it spends, a balanced budget, honestly, a pay-as-you-go system, prices of things would not increase. But the prices of things are increasing and have been increasing for about 100 years now because the government spends more than it takes in. And it makes up that spending by either borrowing money or conjuring it up in air. And economic theory says that when you start going into debt and you start spending debt, you're spending future earnings. What I spend today, I have to pay back later. So we say that I'm spending future earnings. What I spend today, I have to pay back later. So I'm spending future earnings. If everybody spends future earnings, you have a lot more money chasing the prices of goods. So you have a lot more people buying cars because of debt, and a lot more people buying stereos and buying televisions. And even though we've gotten better at making those things, so many people are borrowing and buying so many of these things, the prices are rising. We call that a fixed, an increasing amount of currency, an increasing amount of money chasing a fixed basket of goods. We assume that the goods and services in the world are fixed. We just can't create apples out of air. But we can create the money that buys the apples out of air. So when we do that, it drives the prices higher and higher slowly, slowly. So when you see a price of a candy bar go up from a nickel to a dollar, that's the bill that you are paying for all this government spending over and above what they take in. Now, all of us try to run a balanced household. We try to only spend what we take in. The government doesn't do that. They spend much more than they take in. And that is fairly new. I mean, in the last, you know, scheme of things, people have always fought for governments to be balanced, to go pay as you go. And they only borrowed for things temporarily like World War I or World War II or some problems. But then they always paid the money back. But we've adopted this new paradigm, this new mindset, that the government is okay to keep borrowing. And it's okay to keep spending more than you take in. And people are doing this because people are inherently selfish. We want all the things that we want. And we want all the things that we think we deserve, even though that means borrowing the money from somebody else to get it. So it would be like, let's say Mexico said, you know, we need better roads and we need newer buildings and we need solar arrays and we need more, you know, government buildings and we need more air conditioners. So we're going to go to the United States and we are going to borrow money from the United States and the United States is going to pay for it. We in Mexico are not going to pay for it. You are. Now, despite that all the things that Mexico might want might be beneficial to them and might be good causes, you would still be upset if you were paying for somebody else's improvements. Whether the improvements were good or not, you would still be paying for them and you would say, wait a minute, we need our own improvements. So why are we paying for yours? And in essence, that's what the government's doing. That's what you're doing. So when the government spends money, it's not spending your money. Your money's already spent. That's why it's going into debt. What it's doing is it's spending money of the next generation, just like Mexico would spend the money of ours. And although you think and you believe that the things we're buying are worthwhile, whatever they are, the fact is it's not your money you're spending. You're borrowing it, and the people that are going to have to pay it back are not even born yet. So just like one country spending money and saddling another company with the debt, it's not the thing that you're buying with that debt that's wrong. People always say, well, we need this. This is good. That's not the point. It could be the most worthwhile enterprise on the planet. But the fact is, it's not your money to spend. You're spending it. You've already spent yours. Maybe we should have spent our monies instead of new cars and new freeways, maybe we would have spent our money on the things that people think are important, which are helping people, or whatever social policy you think is important, then maybe you should have spent your money on that instead of buying all these brand new cars and flat screen TVs and everything else. But the damage is done. So when we borrow more and more money because we need this and we need that, you're really borrowing somebody else's money. You're borrowing the next generation's money. So those like myself that profess that we should not be overspending, it's not because the programs we're overspending are not worthwhile. And let's get that clear. Because every time I see an argument saying we should not overspend, we should not buy this thing because we don't have the money, people say, well, this is a good endeavor. I'm not arguing the fact that it's not a good endeavor. That's not the point. We're not arguing the fact that Mexico might need new government buildings and better air conditioners. I'm not arguing that fact. What we are arguing is it's not your money. So no matter what it is you're spending it on, it's not yours. If you want to spend your money, we shouldn't spend it on all this other frivolous garbage that we bought. I mean, in a broad sense of the thing, if you open your mind and look at the grand scheme of things, I always drive down the freeway and I talk to my dad or a friend and I say, do you see everything that is around us? All these billboards, all these fast food joints, all these new cars, these new stadiums. Half of this stuff shouldn't be here. Half of this stuff should not be here. Because half of this stuff is borrowed is paid for with borrowed money. So half of everything you see, of all the improvements you see around you, shouldn't be here. Because we're spending money that's not ours. So it's like a household that goes out and fills its house full of fancy furniture. And you walk in and you say, wow, this is nice. You must be rich. No, I'm not rich. I borrowed it all. So half the stuff all around you should not be here because it's all borrowed. We've got approximately, I don't know, $100 trillion in debt, $60 trillion in debt if you add in what we promised to pay in the future. You got another, you know, the figures are into the hundreds of trillions of dollars that we owe, probably 120 trillion. And we're overspending by about $1 trillion a year. So it's adding to this. So the argument for controlled government spending is not that the programs are not worthwhile. I'll give you that one. The programs you want are worthwhile. We could debate that, but let's not. I'll just give you that one for free. What I am saying is not your money. You spent your money. So maybe you shouldn't have spent it on what we spent it on. But whatever the case is, we've already spent it. So it's not our money. So no matter what we want to spend it on, sorry. Can't do it. Because you're further encumbering people that are not even born yet. I did a couple of shows on that. One is called It's Our Children's Money. And there are other shows that I've done on it. But that's the premise of overspending. Everybody always comes back and says, well, we need this program. That's not the point. I'll give you the fact that we need the program. The point is that we've already spent the money. We've already spent our money. And I'm sorry to hear that. But I don't know, how would you feel if you were born on this planet and somebody kept sending you an invoice and every year you had to pay $1,000 and this would be for all the money that was spent in the 30s and the 40s before you were born? You wouldn't really appreciate that. It's also the thing when you're not borrowing so much money and you don't have so much money available to you in credit, you're a little bit more careful with it. And that's, I think, the economically conservative are not saying let's not have fire and police departments. That's always the argument to the economic liberal will bring up is saying, well, we need fire. We need fire departments and police and good schools. That's true. That's not the argument. The argument is you spent all the money on other things. That's why we still need those things. We should have spent the money on those things instead of the spending money frivolously giving away money to foreign countries and putting on tariffs on cars and taxing this and taxing that and subsidizing that and having 400,000 different government agencies with, you know, 30% of the population, gathering some sort of check from the government. I mean, there's so many people in the cart right now, you got barely enough horses to pull it. So that's not the argument there. The argument would be, doesn't matter what the program is. I'm sure it's worthwhile. I agree with you there. It's just the money is not there. The money is not there. You want to keep borrowing it, then you're borrowing more money from people that haven't even born yet. And that is not just. It's not moral. I got another question here. What's going on with gold and silver, Mark? Well, gold and silver ran up. Let's use gold as the proxy. Gold ran up to about 1900 something an ounce and then came whomping down. And for the last two or three years, it's still down. And It is floating around $1,200 an ounce. Started the run when I did this show at around $450, $550. So it's doubled since 2005, 2006, tripled, 300% increase. Blew right by the Dow and NASDAQ. I mean, gold has tripled since 2005, and the NASDAQ just barely got back to where it was in 2000. So gold and silver have tripled your money. The Dow, meanwhile, has gotten a little bit ahead of itself since 2000. But gold and silver have smoked the Dow. But in the last 3 years, they have underperformed. So I think that I keep saying that we may have a low of gold in around mid-900s and silver around 15 bucks. It did hit 15, so I've revised that to about 12. It may or may not happen, which doesn't do you any good. But I think looking back decades from now, I would not be surprised to see gold much, much higher than where it is, and silver as well. So we will just have to see. Any thoughts on annuities? What types are out there? There are many different annuities. For the most part, I don't really like annuities. A lot of annuities pay very high commissions to the people that sell them to you, which is why they like to sell them to you. And you have to realize they sell annuities as a investment. But in my opinion, annuities are life insurance policies first. I know that people like to sell them as investments. You know, they say, hey, you know, here's what you'll get out of your annuity if the market does what it historically has done. Here's a projection. But it's a projection. Okay, the people that bought annuities in 2000 sure didn't get the projection when the NASDAQ cratered. And the people who bought annuities, you know, in 2004, 2005, that were a specific type of annuity got hammered when the markets crashed. So let's talk a little bit about annuities and what kind and what's out there. Insurance policy, an annuity, is a contract between you and an insurance company. And there are fixed and, let's say, non-fixed. A fixed annuity, the insurance company bears the brunt of the risk. You give them money and they promise to pay you a certain amount for the rest of your life. There are all sorts of hybrids of that, all sorts of variations of that. But that's the basic thing, is if you give somebody a fixed annuity, let's say a whole life policy, then you give them money. Maybe you give them a lump sum or you make payments into it. And then at a certain time, they will give you money back. Now, there's a fixed immediate annuity and a fixed deferred annuity. I mean, if immediate annuity means you give money, give them a lump sum, can't give them payments on a immediate. And they start paying you back. I give you 100 grand, you're going to give me 800 every 3 months for the rest of my life, whatever it is. Deferred annuity means you give money and they sit on it for a while. You have a maturing period, a holding period. And as the can't take it out, if you take it out, they bang you with a withdrawal fee. So they say you got to sit in here for 7 years. And as it sits in there, it accumulates what they call units, insurance units. And it basically says that, you know, you give me this much in 7 years, I start paying you this and I pay you for the rest of your life. And if you die, this is the insurance part of it. If you die, you get a whopper. You get a big payment. So when you buy an insurance policy, an annuity, not term insurance is different, just an annuity, you're buying a life insurance policy wrapped in an investment product. And the hook on the annuity is if you die, your estate makes out very well if you die fairly quickly, which is kind of sick. That's a fixed annuity, okay, or whole life policy. Then there are other types of annuities. Let's say if there's a variable annuity and a variable deferred annuity and all sorts of different variations on it. But in the fixed annuity or whole life policy, the insurance company guarantees you. They take your money and you're on the hook. They're on the hook to pay you. So if the insurance company goes under, your money's gone. Now, Do insurance companies go under? Yeah, they do. But most of the time, they're so big, the government bails them out if they do run into trouble. We found that out. So for the most part, your money's fairly safe when you buy it in a big annuity, my opinion. Then you can buy what they call a variable annuity. Now, a variable annuity, or an indexed annuity, is an annuity where your money is put into something. And what you get is dependent on what that something does. An indexed annuity might put its money into the market indexes like the Dow or the whatever it puts it into, under stocks or whatever. Or you might just have a variable annuity where you pick the investments. You pick out of a certain amount of menu that might give you, or you just pick out whatever you want. So that is based on the underlying performance of the annuity, which means they'll still pay you through the rest of your life, but your payments could go down or up depending on what the underlying asset does. So the insurance company is no longer on the hook for the payment. The underlying index that you bought into is what your payment is based on. Now, if you die, they still got to give you a death penalty, death thing, but variable annuity, index annuity, a little bit different. So in a fixed annuity, it's just like a contract. Here's a contract. Give me the money. I'll pay you this much until you die. Variable annuity basically says, here's my money. Put in the stocks, and I'll live with whatever happens. So in a variable annuity, it's you're at risk. What the stocks do underneath you are at risk. That's the problem. The downside of either side of this is there's always fees. There's the insurance policy fee. They got a death benefit. So there's a death benefit fee. If we're going to pay you $500,000 if you kick and you only gave us $100,000, we're going to charge you every year just like a regular insurance policy is. So there's that fee, and then there's managerial fees, and then buried in there is usually a commission somewhere. So I'm a fan of term insurance where it's cheap. Term insurance is you buy an insurance policy and you just buy it for 10 years, and then in 10 years you pay a little bit amount every year, and then if you don't die, they keep the money. But an annuity is a whole another ball game, and I just think they're very expensive. You know, insurance companies never lose on a basket of annuities because they have the statistics in their favor. They already know how many people are going to die. They're pretty good at telling you when you're going to die, and you're all averaged out, and they're going to make money. You know, if you take out an annuity tomorrow, a fixed annuity, and you get hit by a car, they lose money on you. But they have other people that are going to keep paying and paying and paying. So I'm not a big fan of annuities. They can be fairly high commission products. There's supposed to be full disclosure on the commissions that are paid to the people that sell them to you, but I can tell you how many investors I've talked to that had no idea that their salesman was getting a big check or continually get a big check. And I think desperately there's things wrong with the disclosure parts of the industry, of which I'm a part. So, you know. So anyway, that's my take on annuities. I really don't like annuities. My dad has one from Salvation Army, but I'm not a real big fan of them because the fees are so high. It's just too many fees. And you could park the money in something yourself that would pay you, and then you would have control of the money. You would get the payments and you still have the money. In an annuity, you give them the money and they make payments and you don't have the money anymore. Right? When you give an insurance company money on an annuity, they have it. And when you die, it's gone. They take it. Where if I put my money in, you know, bank account, then I get the interest from the bank account, and when I die, the money's still there. That's the difference. In an annuity, they take the money and it's gone. If I do it on my own income yielding assets, then I get the income. And I still have the money. That's the nice part about it. And there is a theory out here called the war cycle. Now, there are a lot of technical analysis on stocks and markets. Different cycles, summer, winter, fall, cycle in nations and summers and in seasons. And there are certain analysts that believe in the war cycle. The theory is based on recurring periods of intense infighting between nations. And the war cycle says that as income inequality intensifies and poverty spreads, you get into what is called a war cycle. It is believed by some that the globe is now coming into a major war cycle, and that it has an economic effect, which is why we look at it from the economic point of view. Obviously, it has an effect on people that are living and dying, but we're looking at it from an economic point of view. They say that we're coming into a major war cycle, and it's hard to disagree with that when you look around the world. I bet you didn't know how many skirmishes we are having on the planet today. Israel and Gaza are still fighting, of course. Russia is bullying the Ukraine. Syria's civil war now has claimed almost 250,000 lives. Africa has 24 countries doing battle and 146 different guerrilla groups doing that. In Asia, 15 countries are in war or uprisings, and that is involving over 125 separatist and radical groups. Europe has 9 countries under siege by 70 different militias. The Middle East has 8 countries with 169 different rebel groups. And the Americas down south have 5 countries. They're witness to 25 different rebel groups and drug cartels at each other's throats. Of course, the notable one that we hear about today is ISIS, the Islamic State. And, of course, there's differing Muslim groups that were at war with each other, and Christians, something that's been going on for centuries. These are only the official conflicts. There's many more uprisings taking place all over the planet as man aims to kill his fellow man. When you take all this in consideration, and all this killing and bloodshed, it is possible that the war cycle truly represents a valid cause and effect economic theory. And we are possibly coming into the midst of this cycle. So the theory tells us that if we are coming into a war cycle, the markets generally rock and roll, oil and gold will usually go up in price, and the standard run-of-the-mill safe havens of regular stocks can possibly become a minefield of investor casualties. I myself don't know if the war cycle is a valid theory or not, but with all the blood being shed, it's hard to argue that something is up, that something is not up, and being prudent and careful with your investing dollars might not be a bad idea. And when I say prudent and careful, I just like bank savings accounts just to be safe. So in any case, that's something to concern. I'd like to thank Money and Markets for making me aware of the war cycle and some of their newsletters, Money and Markets. That's Martin Weiss's group. And of course, in the horse racing world, American Pharoah won the coveted Triple Crown. And how much money was bet on that? It's been 37 years since the last racehorse won all three races, the Preakness, the Belmont, and the Kentucky Derby. A horse named Affirmed did it in 1978. Behind him was Seattle Slough, Secretariat, and Citation. Only 11 horses have won all three races in the same year, dating back to 1919. The horse, of course, a Mr. Ed saying from that old TV sitcom. And if you would have put a buck down on American Pharoah to win the Triple Crown, you would have won 60 cents. But you can imagine all the betting that went on for this horse to win the third race of the coveted Triple Crown. Literally millions of dollars will change hands, and did change hands in the days and months and weeks following the race. But the big winner, unbelievably, will be probably the horse's owner, Ahmed Zayat. He's the head of Zayat Stables, who owns a 200-plus horse operation that competes in racetracks across the country. American Pharoah won about $800,000 of the $1.5 million prize money, but that pales in comparison to the amount of money the horse will command now in stud fees, procreation activities by the horse since he's male. Interestingly enough, Mr. Zayat, the owner of American Pharoah, sold the stud fees after the horse won the second race, the Preakness. I guess he thought, well, I was lucky enough to win two. That's good enough. I'll sell the rights. Somebody had offered him $20 million for the stud rights of American Pharoah prior to the third race. He turned it down. But then somebody offered him more, and he said it was something he could not refuse. So north of $20 million is what is reported, what was paid to Mr. Zayat to get the stud fees from American Pharoah. It's estimated that American Pharoah will make about $100,000 per foal that he produces, which could be as much as $5 to $7 million a year as long as he is able. The horse's father, Pioneer of the Nile, American Pharoah's father, who studded American Pharoah, is still alive. He makes about $60,000 per foal because he's fathered a lot of other successful horses. So Pioneer of the Nile's been the man. Now that American Pharoah has won the Triple Crown, Pioneer of the Nile's owner will also probably charge more. So we got two people here that have the stud fees to these great horses. Now that's not a bad lot for racehorses or its owners. Most of the people that own racehorses have the money to lose because there's not many horses that really win. But when you do win, it's good to be king. And, of course, looks like we're not going to be able to have enough time to cover the unit investment trust that I was going to be talking about. That's sort of an obscure investment. We'll talk about that on another show. But the Dow bouncing around again above 18,000. 18,000 on the Dow, a level breached and broken many times now in the last 6 months. I thought it was going to be breached twice, three times, and then make a break and make a run for it or fall. But it hasn't. It's gone up and down over this 18,000 a lot, so it is consolidating. This back and forth seesawing around 18,000 is a period of consolidation. And it's got a lot of people guessing what's going to happen. Markets can consolidate or oscillate in these little up, 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 down, up, down, up, down, up, down over a particular level, like 18,000. They can go 1-2 years oscillating. But what happens is if they oscillate a longer, real long time, they eventually break. And we don't know if they break up or break down. That's the question. A sideways churning market is said to be coiling like a spring. And when the spring blows, it can possibly be violent and massive, either up or down. Nothing is written in stone, however, but the markets love to get boring just before they're not. For now, we observe this oscillation back and forth and look for clues as to which way it'll go and when. For now, there are a few clues. There are clues saying it'll break up and clues saying it'll break down. So again, once again, I would say, let's be safe together, and I like savings accounts for safety. That's what I like. And one of the reasons the market is having its trouble is back in the news for the 100th time is Greece. Now, they have a new prime minister there, Mr. Syriza, or that's his party. Tsipras, I think, is his name, or however you pronounce it. Anyway, Greece has been borrowing money and promising to pay it back, and they can't. And then they get more loans, and they promise to pay it back, and they can't. And they get more loans, and they promise to pay it back, and they can't. And Greece has been trying the word austerity. We're cutting back on pension programs and cutting back on social programs, and we're cutting back by firing employees of the government. And as a result, Greece's unemployment is massive. It's a problem you get into when the government takes over so much of the economy. When the government wants to scale back, it can't, which is a good cause to keep the government small, because if the government has to scale back, it doesn't affect the economy. But it's not the case in today's world, in most of the continents today. The governments are too large a part of an economy, in my opinion, and when they have to scale back, the economy craters. Now, you got to realize the government is not really part of the economy. It is a hole in the economy. It just eats money. It puts some back, but it takes some for itself. So it's a negatively correlated. The more money it takes, the more money the economy as a whole loses. Because the government never takes a dollar and puts back a dollar. Government takes a dollar in taxes or revenue and puts back 50 cents or whatever it puts back. So it's a big hole in the bucket. It's like transferring water from one place to another, and your bucket has a hole in it. So you pick the water out of one place, and you move it over to the other place, but as you're moving it, some of the water leaks out. So that's the government for you. It's a leaking hose. So the more the government takes, the more the economy as a whole loses. So those out there that are for increasing taxes even more, you have to realize when you increase taxes even more, you're transferring more water in and out of the bucket, which means more water spills on the ground and you waste it. The economy being the big pool of water. We want the pool of water to be as high as possible. In that particular case, you don't want to transfer water with a bucket with a hole in it. So if you want the economy to be as big as possible, you don't want the government to be taking out funds from the economy because there's a hole in the bottom. So that alone would say that if you want the economy to stay full and be prosperous, you want less taxes. Anything that doesn't go to the government stays in the pool. Anything that goes to the government, some of it drops out on the water and you put back less. That's just the way it works. Show me a government that operates with no cost, and I'll show you another different universe, a completely parallel universe where things work. But government costs. They also waste money. Everybody knows that. Everybody will agree government costs money and it wastes money. So a dollar spent by the government is very inefficient. It's a wasted dollar. Not all of it, but a lot of it is. So Greece has been trying to cut back, causing tons of unemployment. People didn't like it because the people are kind of surface. People only vote with their wallet. They say, well, I'm suffering, so I don't really care what happens. I want more money in my wallet. So along comes a new official, and he promises that he will end the cutbacks. Doesn't matter how I'm going to do it. I'm just going to end the cutbacks. So since people vote for their wallet, and they are being told that they will be given more money and the cutbacks won't be there, they voted him in. Now he's come in. Now he's saying, I want another loan, but I'm not going to cut back my spending. Well, all the other countries in the Euro bloc are saying, you got to cut back your spending. And he's going, no, I'm not. I'm not going to do it. A lot of the Greek citizens are going, right on. You tell them. Well, the only reason the European Central Bank is not telling them to go take a flying you-know-what is because they don't want Greece to leave the euro currency. Because if Greece owes a lot of money and they leave the euro currency, all the other countries that owe a lot of money, which is France and Italy and Spain, Portugal, and a lot of the other ones in there. Portugal in there? I think so. I don't know. Yeah, I think it's over there. All of those will say, well, look, Greece got out of its debts by leaving. Why don't we leave? And it would shake the euro currency block, all these nations participate in. So they're trying to keep Greece in the euro. But this guy, Tsipras, he's drawn a hard line. He's basically saying, no, I'm not going to cut back my spending. You don't want me to leave. I know you don't want me to leave, so I got you over the barrel. You're going to give me my money. So the IMF is getting emotional, or the European Central Bank, excuse me, is getting emotional. And Germany, who foots a lot of the bill, is getting emotional. They're saying, look, that's it. This is our final, final offer, which may be the final offer, but may not be the final offer. So we're going down the line, and Greece's due dates are coming. They're going to be owing some payments, and they don't have the money to pay. Not only that, their banks are in trouble. What's Greece's option? Well, if Greece pulls out of the euro, I'm not quite sure what will happen to the euro. I told you before, Greece will never pay. It will never be enough. I told you many times the last 3 years, it won't be enough. And here we are, 2015. I was telling you in 2011, 10, when the Greece problem arrived, they'll never pay. So 4 years later, I'm tooting my horn. I told you they'd never pay. Now, I don't think they'll withdraw, but things are getting hot. Things are getting emotional. So now it is possible that Greece will withdraw. In fact, I think they've probably got an exit strategy, at least the European Central Bank. I don't know if Greece has an exit strategy. What will happen? I'm not quite sure what will happen to the euro currency when Greece withdraws. It could skyrocket. Finally, we got rid of the deadbeat brother-in-law. Now, what will happen is if they exit from the euro currency, there'll be a lot of banks that hold Greek debt in euros. They will not get paid. So what I think will happen is the European Central Bank will line up all the banks. Are we talking bailout? Yes, we are. They're going to line up all the banks and say, okay, how much in Greek euro debt do you have? Okay, we will pay it all off for you. So none of the banks will be in trouble. And that way, we will have to print more money, but at least we will end the problem. I'm going to pay off all the banks, print up and do another bank bailout, but the problem will be gone. And then Greece will be on their own. Versus if they give more money to Greece and print up a lot of money and pay Greece, they will pay the banks partial, and then Greece will be back again. So in one way, if Greece pulls out, I think the European Central Bank should just let them pull out and pay off it all. Pay off all the loans. We don't really agree with the bailout, but they're going to do it. So The option of not paying the banks off is not on the table. They're going to do it. Otherwise, they'll have another systemic banking problem throughout the world, and you'll see that all happen again. But at least if you pay off the banks once, there will be no more debt, and Greece will not be allowed to come back and keep borrowing. So we're going to pay it once, and that's it. I'm going to tear the credit card up and pay off the bills. Now, Greece does get another loan. I'm telling you, they're going to be back again because they're not going to cut back. Now, as far as Greece is concerned, be careful what you wish for, people. Because if Greece pulls out, Greece will then print the drachma, and it will pay its bills in drachma. And now that they're out of the large euro country block, as far as the currency concerned, and they start printing drachma, they're going to print till the cows come home, and we are going to reach a Mexican peso moment. Greece will see incredible inflation, the likes of which will make the Argentinian news, because Argentina has tremendous inflation too. So Greece will see tremendous inflation, and Greece probably won't be able to borrow any more money. So they will print the money they need, and as the more money they print, the more inflation they will see, and then they will really not be able to borrow more money, and you will see Greece spiral upwards into some sort of highly inflationary environment, somewhat toward a hyperinflationary environment, which is what Argentina is in, and they're going to be a mess. So the Greek citizens think that if they're pulling out of the euro, they're still going to get their checks. Well, what they realize is those checks aren't going to be able to buy squat. So be careful what you wish for, Greek citizens. It's an ugly way. I think if I was a Greek citizen that had a brain, I would want them to renegotiate and say, well, look, we got to go on austerity, and some people are going to have to go hungry. Because the other way is going to look okay for about 3, 6, 9 months. I think immediately you'll see prices start to skyrocket in Greece, but it won't reach critical mass for 3, 6 months, maybe a year. And then they're going to be in real trouble. Trust me on this one. As for the euro, where other countries pull out, if they don't pull out immediately, they may see the resulting hyperinflation that's going to take place in Greece and say, well, pulling out sounded like a good idea, but we're not going to pull out because look what's happening over there. So it's going to be interesting run. I think we may see a relief rally when Greece was going to pull out, where the market would continue to go down, but now I think the market is pretty much accepting the fact that Greece may pull out. And we may see a relief rally. Everything may skyrocket because the problem is gone until the next country comes up and says, hey, guess what? Greece found an exit. We're looking at that too. So we'll see what's going to happen over in Greece problem. No more grease on the fire, please. But I think we're going to see even more grease on the fire. And what can I say? It's money matters all over again. And that concludes another edition of your Economic Forum entitled Money Matters. This has been edition 213. Oh, no more grease on the fire. Feel free to send me an email at moneymatters@kvmr.org for questions or comments on the show or copies of the actual audio. Mark@moneymatters.org. Is that right? No. Moneymatters@kvmr.org. Woo! Okay, 60s are good for me. Moneymatters@kvmr.org. Show number 213. And that concludes today. Thanks for listening. You'll have a good time. We'll keep an eye on the markets for you. And if you'd like our newsletter from your community radio station for no cost, just send me an email at moneymatters@kvmr.org. And you can get the email and get some of this stuff in writing. And if you'd like copies of the show mailed to your home, that's possible, too. Send me an email as well, and I'll put you in contact with membership, and we can set you up. My name's Mark. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.
This has been another edition of Money Matters. Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests, and are opinions only, and may not represent those of this station, its staff, members, or underwriters. This show is not meant as investment advice. Consult a qualified financial advisor before making any investment decisions, and do your own research before investing. The information given on the show was obtained from a variety of public sources and is deemed accurate at time of airing, but is not guaranteed. This show was pre-recorded at an earlier date, so the market indices and related stock market references may not be accurate at the time of airing. You can order past shows or comment on our show by sending me an email at mark@moneymanagementradio.com. Money Matters is produced and recorded at the studios of KVMR FM 89.5 in Nevada City, California. You can visit our website at moneymanagementradio.com. Thanks for listening.